This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday, September 13th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker alongside the usual crew. Today, from the DRF offices in New York, we have Mike Hogan.
Hello, Pete.
And from an undisclosed location in Texas, last year's NHC Tour champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, what's up?
Oh, man, nothing much. I was looking at the calendar yesterday, getting excited about Breeders' Cup, and realized it's still 8 weeks away. So,
8 weeks away, that should be just enough time to handicap the fascinating array of races. I know my handicapping, my course playing in general, has already started to shift in that direction. I'm going to be up in Woodbine this weekend. Any Toronto area listeners should really consider getting involved in this live bankroll contest. I'm going to be in attendance for on Saturday. But what I'm really excited about is a chance to see the horses not only showing up for the Woodbine Mile, but some of these other stakes races, including the interesting races for two-year-olds on Sunday. Looking forward to the chance of going down to the paddock and maybe making some notes I can use to help in handicapping those juvenile turf races. Always seem to be some interesting opportunities in those. But yeah, it's a little bit like the calm before the storm right now, because the Breeders' Cup stuff isn't it's not exactly imminent. It's just like we've turned towards that, you know, with the summer meets in the rearview window. And speaking of the summer meets, we've got kind of a loosey-goosey, free-flowing show today where I'm just going to throw out a bunch of questions and we can sort of round-table them and bandy them back and forth, and guys feel free to, propose some of your own topics along the way. But let's start off, before we continue to look forward to the Breeders' Cup, looking back at the summer meets. Specifically, any highs and lows we might want to highlight? A particular memory, you can do one of each, Mike, or you can pick one of the other. Highs and lows in terms of your betting this summer.
Well, let's see. My low probably was I can't remember which turf stakes race it was, but it was one of the filly and mare ones where I was all over Reina de Bateria. And she ran a fantastic race. I think it was the second long. The Diana, there you go. She was the fourth of four Chad Brown entered. She was the longest price. She might have been the second longest price of any of the horses in the race. She ran a huge race, got clobbered in the stretch, missed by a couple noses. That was my low light because had things been slightly better, I don't know, even know how much we'd be talking about. I didn't go in too much, but I was very, very thickly alive to her in various multis and got absolutely nothing out of it. So that was kind of a low light. And that sort of started at least a few weeks, maybe. It felt like it lasted a few weeks of just losing out on heartbreaking photos. Which was kind of the other low light of the meet. It seemed like I lost probably the first eight photos I was involved in. And then it slowly started to turn for the better. The highlight of the meet for me, I mean, I was talking about the Grand Slam. The Grand Slam, I went back and I looked at my bets from the meet. By far my biggest ROI, like it's not even close, was the Grand Slam. I had a $10 ROI on Grand Slam bets.
What was your typical approach? I know you've talked about some of the ways you look at that bet before. In other podcasts, but do you typically have one way you look at that bet, or does it just depend on the runners and you have a couple of different templates you use?
Yeah, I typically have one approach, which is I want a single in the last leg. So a single in the feature race, second to last race of the day. And I'm in my other betting, I tend to avoid short prices, just because there's usually not any value there. In the Grand Slam, I love getting alive to a favorite. And that happened probably four or five times where I would, in the early legs, not include any of the favorites, especially if I felt like they were vulnerable. I mean, I wouldn't throw out, say, Flincher necessarily. But certainly in maiden races or in two-year-old maiden races, I would use the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh choices sometimes, hoping to get one, two, or even all three of them through, because you just have to hit the board. So I would maybe do a $20 from a $1 bet, 18 to 20, roughly, you know, figure out what the multipliers are. But maybe an 18, 2 by 3 by 3 by 1 as my main bet, and then do a few other backup bets where I press other opinions more heavily. The biggest result from that standpoint was I got alive to Turco Bravo, who was 4 to 5 in whatever race, whatever that stakes race was. It was completely a $12 bet. I got alive, 4 of my dollars carried through to Turco Bravo, and the $12 bet returned $1,300 or something for a 4 to 5 shot. So that's usually my approach. And if the favorites end up chalking out in the early legs, I'm usually knocked out, but the Grand Slam is going to pay $15 anyway, and I don't want it.
Right. No, that's a fair approach. Jonathan, having seen you at the windows, it wouldn't surprise me if you've never placed a Grand Slam bet in your life. But I'm curious, is it a wager that's ever been on your radar? And do you like Mike's approach to it, or does another approach come to your mind?
I actually did play it one time this weekend, or this summer for the first time. And I was influenced by Mike's discussion of it. So, yeah, I mean, like I've said before, jokingly, like if they're running in a circle and you can bet on them, I don't really care what the bet is, as long as they're, you know, whatever, I'm good for it. So, and to answer your original question, you know, this is going to sound like not real, like I'm making this up because it sounds better, but I really don't. I forget my bad beats. They sting me for way too long in the moment. Like, I'll sit there for 4 hours and stew over it, but if you ask me a week or two after that, I don't remember them. And I just kind of put them away. The highlight of the meet for me this summer at Saratoga was I felt like my strike rate with low price singles was the best it's ever been. I mean, I really feel like I couldn't miss a short price single the entire summer. But it was the other legs that were kind of catching me a little bit. So, that was good. I mean, the way that I play and the people that have seen me play, if I'm hitting short price singles, you know, there's a shot that I'm going to be live for some money. So that was good. And then my involvement in the pick six with Lau Band, Jim Dandy Day. So those are the highlights for me.
No, that makes sense. And as if to prove your point about not remembering bad beats, you're talking about not missing a short price single the whole meet. I do recall getting an excited text message from you telling me I had to go get the second mortgage out on the house to bet Ektot late in the meet. For those who didn't see that race, let's just say it wasn't pretty.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I didn't bet any multis that day. So, the strike rate stays intact.
There you go. But I will admit that is a skill I think that you seem to have particularly strong, that ability to find, because I think that sort of blanket approach, and a lot of contest players have this blanket approach, never bet a favorite, or what Mike said before, you know, he doesn't believe there's a lot of value in short price favorites. I actually disagree. I'm more on Jonathan's side of the fence with this. It's a question of finding the right ones and the right ways to leverage them across various pools. There's nobody better than Jonathan Kinchin when it comes to trying to find those tentpole favorites. So let me ask you this, Jonathan. What quality are you looking for in a horse like that, or does it just totally depend on the race? I have a theory, but I'm curious how you'll answer that question first.
It's typically, like I've said before, it's typically forwardly placed horses that possess a distinct, you know, speed advantage or pace advantage in a race, where, you know, they're the best on paper regardless, but they're also going to have a favorable pace setup. I don't typically lean towards closers in those situations because, you know, we can still see negative things happen, but in those situations, but that's pretty much it for me. I mean, horses that just possess a pace advantage, but also a class, you know, when all of them line up, when I just like think of every scenario the horse can't lose, those are kind of the ones that I lean on. But the other thing is, you know, counter to that point that favorites don't really, you know, they don't present a lot of value. One of the other reasons I disagree with that is because one of the biggest wastes of money that I think that you can that you can do when you're playing multi-race tickets is waste money on combinations and legs where horses don't have a chance of winning. And I think that's what happens when you're spending money to beat a flincher, when you're spending money to beat a horse that's dropping in class that is going to be loose on the lead and is 10 points better on the buyer scale than everyone else. Like, there's no reason to try to get cute and to outthink yourself with a horse that's 10-1. You're going to waste money. You're going to spend twice as much money as you would if you would just single the horse. So that's kind of where the value comes for me. It might not be the value on the tote board, but the value in getting a better ROI by limiting the amount of combinations that I'm spending.
Well, that idea of spreading in combinations is something that's worth a little bit of further explanation and or exploration anyway, and we'll get there. Just wanted to say, Jonathan, you've been nothing but sounding great the last 26 podcasts. Today we're a little back more in that way that it was in the bad old days with the a little bit of cut out. I don't know if there's anything you can do mid-show. But if there is, that would be awesome. If not, I think we can suffer through. It's not that bad. But I just throwing that out there. But as for that idea, I think a lot of people don't realize that in multi-race betting, especially if you're including shorter price horses, like quote unquote defensively, you can often put yourself in a situation where you hit the leg of the bet, but your equity's actually going way down, because of the fact that you've got this shorter price horse valued the same as some of these, as several long shots. I feel like, and I've really tried to get away from ever doing that, if I'm going to use the short price horse, I'm going to press that combination, or I'm just going to try to beat the horse, or I'm going to try to use my opinion in a different pool. I don't like the idea of getting through the middle leg in a pick three and using four horses, two of whom, if they hit, I'm still essentially losing equity in my overall play. Is that something, Jonathan, that you ever consider?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's like, you know, that's to me, that's one of the – there's nothing – well, there's a lot of things worse. But one of the worst things that you can do as a horse player is hit a bet and lose money. Like – there's nothing that makes me more sick than spending, you know, $108 on the pick four and it comes back $55. It's like, oh my God, what was I doing? And then you look back at the sequence, there's always going to be a horse that you could have leaned on heavily and you tried to get cute. You know, it goes back to that thing where I've always said, like, I try to bet what I think is going to happen, not what I hope will happen.
Yeah, that's a fair way of looking at it. Though I will just bring up a quick counterpoint, and Mike, I want your buy-in on this too, but we'll have Jonathan answer first. I'm a big believer in the idea that money, if you're a real horse player, you're out there grinding, you're playing all the time, money not lost is the same thing at the end of the year as money won. So I don't mind sometimes in a bet like a pick four, if I make a serious investment, if I can get 80% of my money back and I just wasn't right about my main opinion that was going to make me money, the bet had upside, that upside doesn't come in, but I caught a couple of things to get me 80% of my money back, I don't complain in that situation. Is that something that would make you upset still, Jonathan?
No, I completely agree, but I think that when you win a bet, like you said, not win a bet, but when you can get 80% of your investment back, I sure as heck would like to have had an opportunity to have won more money if something else would have kind of gone a different way. I think that sometimes people are kind of dead from the start, just the way they bet their tickets. You know,
yeah, that's a great point.
It's a ticket maker, you know, situation where if I get back 80%, but at some point during the sequence I was alive for a 500% return, then okay, I'm cool with it. It makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. You have to make for what I said to be true. Jonathan's point remains 100% correct. You have to have that upside. You can't be going into it with an upside of getting even money on a four race sequence. At least I never have. Maybe there's some way through very complicated Dutching type betting techniques to arrange something like that. But the way most people play their tickets, that seems like a difficult thing. Mike, does this factor into the way that you play the horses at all?
Oh, absolutely. You know, my approach is exactly what you guys are talking about. When I say that I usually avoid short price favorites, I'm not saying like I'll be stubborn and toss them out if a horse has the advantage like Jonathan's describing. I mean, there was a horse on, I think it was Sunday, sometime over the weekend at Belmont, AC Avila horse, who towered over the field on speed figures and was the horse that looked to be fastest early. And he won and paid 540 or whatever in a short field. That's the kind of horse that I will happily single. And I think that's exactly the kind of horse that Jonathan's talking about. But what I will do is, if I get 80% of my investment back, I'm very happy with that. But for me, that's more of a hedge or a fallback. If my main opinion is what gives me 80% back, then I've absolutely bet it wrong. And I can guarantee you that will never happen the way I play my multis.
Yeah. I would say this, though. There are situations in the double when you're limiting it to only two races. I have certainly seen times where I feel like an 80% return on my money is fine if I can lock it up with enough short price. Typically in that situation, you're going to be dealing with some shorter prices. I don't have a problem at all if I truly feel I have races locked up. I mean, there's times where there'll be a two-race sequence where I'm, two-thirds sure or three-quarters sure that I've got the right combinations. If I can turn that into 80%, I'll take it every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Is that just sort of against your betting religion, Mike?
Yeah, I usually don't spread in the double. I'll go maybe 1 by 3 if there's a horse that I think is really providing value in the double. But I rarely go multiple in both legs of the double. I would never do a 4 by 3 double or a 4 by 2 or anything like that. I usually do 1 by 2, single. That's the way I approach the doubles. And sometimes I will use the double as a hedge tool for a multi-race wager. Like, for instance, if I'm alive in the third leg of a pick four and I don't have a certain horse covered that I'm worried about, I'll use that horse in the double to the horses that I have in the last leg to protect me.
Jonathan, are you the type to ever do that sort of spready double that I was describing, or do you look at it more like Mike does?
Only when you bet every combination individually weighted based on the probables, like on the Wilpe or the probables. So essentially, if I like American Pharoah and Keen Ice, I'm going to have a $100 double with American Pharoah and a $25 double with Keen Ice, even though we know the outcome of that race. If they ran it again, there's no way that would win. So I'm going to bet it the correct way again.
Well, hey, but listen, they ran against each other more than once. You're thinking of the one, right, Jonathan? So in how many other times they competed against each other, you would have been right.
Poor Elliot has to listen to us bad mouthing his horse. He gets it on Twitter all the time, and now he listens to the podcast and has to hear us poor his game horse who had the best day of his life at exactly the right time. And months later, Jonathan's still bitter. And I appreciate it.
You know what, though? Not to change the subject, but I did sit next to Dale Romans in the airport at Saratoga for like an hour for our flight being delayed and got to pick his brain and talk to him about random horses. And he swears up and down he knew he was going to win. He said, he goes, American Pharoah looked tired when I saw him, and I knew we were going to win. I knew we had him that day. And he told his son walking over, we're going to win today. So I don't know if it's a story or not, but I believe him.
Maybe if he had something to do with the riding instructions, that would be about the only way I would have had that amount of confidence in that spot. But hey, he's a sharp guy. He's been around the racetrack a long time. And sometimes you got to trust your intuition, even if it sounds crazy to other people. And I think there's a lot of people who've made their living out of doing that. So I'm certainly respectful of that. But yeah, for me, I would say also, just to get back to that original question about the double, of course, I'm not going to play a 4x2 double unweighted too often. But that's one great thing about the double. You have a chance to see those probable pays right there in front of you. You could do a little quick math and have a chance to see what's going to pay what and weight your opinion accordingly, either to Dutch it, in other words, get the same amount of money won for each combination you're playing, or more the way that Jonathan was approaching it there, where you're pressing it based on your opinion, so you're okay winning maybe different amounts or maybe the same amount, just depending on what you think about that particular sequence. I had another handicapping question I wanted to hit you with, Jonathan, before we proceed. We will do a little bit of looking back at last weekend, and we're going to talk about some of the stuff in the news before we get a little bit later in the show to a to a listener question that came in that I want to bandy about for a bit. But my handicapping question for you was about the tools you use. You talked before about the short price singles and how when they have a pace advantage, how that will allow you to play them with more confidence. You've also talked on the show, I remember very specifically when I picked King Creesa in that race. I guess now it was probably two races back at Belmont when obviously won. And you pointed out that a horse like King Creesa for you did his best in slower paced races where he was able to control or pounce, but not pounce against another quality speed horse. And that observation was a very good observation, and it stuck with me and resonates with something I was just recently speaking to our buddy Mike Maloney about, the whole concept of the horse who's the best of the speed. And I was just curious to get a little bit more insight from you about how you determine who the best speed horse is going to be in these matchups and how you use that concept of pace in your handicapping generally.
Well, one of the easiest things you can do, excuse me, is I usually have talked about this before. I try to map out how I think the pace is going to unfold, and then I handicap from front to back. So I handicap for who I think is going to be on the front. That'll be the horse that I look at first. And then who's going to be last early will be the one that I handicap last. And so one of the things I'll do is you'll typically see there's about three horses or whatever that you think are going to be close to the pace. And then I immediately go to the Moss pace figures. And I start to determine, based on their past races, which one of those three horses or two horses or four horses or whatever it might be. Sometimes you'll learn that it's only one. I'll see which of those has the best kind of early speed numbers. And that's the horse that I would project to clear. Even if that horse doesn't clear, that's the horse that I project to have the best chance, obviously, with the three or four horses that I think are going to be forwardly placed. Those other three horses become extremely less likely, in my opinion, because it already seems like there's going to be a little bit of a contested pace. Now I know that when it's time for the real running to start, this horse that has the highest Moss pace figures, in my opinion, is going to be the one that's putting the most pressure on those other horses, which would either set it up for someone coming from off the pace or is going to keep that kind of best of the speed on the front end to wire the field. So best of speed is one of the things, one of the biggest notes that I put in when I'm watching is if there's a three horse press or a three horse kind of vie for the lead, I'll always put, I don't care if the horse finished seventh or first, if the horse was best of the speed horses that he was in the early mix with, I'll write best of the speed, and then I'll put worst of the speed, which with the speed horse that kind of finished the furthest back. So I hope that answers the question.
The answers are great. I've never really heard about the worst of the speed. That's an interesting idea. Just get the idea that they dueled in there. Are those horses that you're typically going to be against the next time, or does it just totally depend on the those worst of speed horses? I mean, are you not interested in them at all, or if they then project to be the only speed, you'll still bet them with confidence the next time?
No, I think it would lean to being against them, but also, you know, I think that's kind of a dangerous assumption to always make. It would be a lean against, but more importantly, it would be used as a tool to tell a story without having to watch the tape back when you're looking in your notes.
And of course, that's the magic of Formulator. You can have these notes slugged right into the lines of your PPs and see it, see that information right there. Yeah, I'm just curious if you ever in that situation will, where you have a horse that doesn't project to make the lead, but they've shown finishing ability, they're in the early pace mix, but they've shown finishing ability in the past. Like, how do you differentiate between a horse like that and just sort of a speed horse who you feel like needs to have be on the lead or have it be soft? Do you not look for those type of horses?
Well, I used to look for finishing with forwardly placed horses, but then I started to realize that the reason they're finishing typically is because they're not going very fast early.
Yeah.
They're allowed to be forward without as much energy used. And so I think if you project them in a race that they're going to have to be asked a little bit more, that late kick is going to be a little bit more dull than you would project that it would be on paper. So I want forwardly placed horses to do their running early. I could care less about their ability to finish because I think that is strictly an indicator of how the previously run races were run early, not so much that they're this horse that can be forwardly placed and finished, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. You're talking about dirt racing here, obviously, and it's just a well-known thing that the real running in dirt races happens in the early part of the race. I'm not saying that finish means nothing. I might not go as far as you with that statement, but I think there's no doubt that if you're looking it from a pace handicapper's point of view, if you're looking at a dirt race and you're looking at the part of the race that happens up to the pace call and the part of the race that happens after the pace call. So we're talking about 4 furlongs in sprints and 6 furlongs in a route. That running that happens up to the hinge of the race is going to be the determining factor in, oh my gosh, I don't know, 80% more. So I think your approach makes it makes a lot of intuitive sense. I was just trying to find if there was something in the way that you looked at the world to account for sort of the push button type horse. Let's say American Pharoah, he never really faced the situation against another quality speed horse, so we'll invent a race that didn't happen. If it's the Breeders' Cup Classic last year, if the Dirt Mile was never invented, and it's the Breeders' Cup Classic last year, and Liam's Map, a quality speed horse, is in there against the Pharoah, I have a feeling, having just watched that horse run his whole career, Pharoah would have not necessarily dueled with him, but just sort of sat off him and been able to finish because he was such a push-button horse. I don't know that I feel like he would have been discouraged by even a quality speed horse like Liam's Map. So let me ask you, Jonathan, first of all, do you think I'm right that that's what would have happened in that scenario? And two, how do you differentiate? Do you just say a horse like American Pharoah is a freak and we don't have to worry because we don't see those kind of horses too often? Or is there some other aspect to it?
Well, I mean, I think to answer your question directly, if Liam's Map runs in the Classic, American Pharoah in hand gallops past Liam's Map on his wrong lead, the eighth pole, and wins for fun either way. So, I mean, I think that's kind of a trickier comparison just because of how good he is. I think that the question is probably better framed in a you know, next level allowance race on a Wednesday. I mean, a first level allowance race on a Wednesday. And I think the answer is that in my opinion, why I like speed horses so much is I just feel like their tactical advantage by allowing to place themselves in a position where they're more likely to win than horses coming from off the pace is the starting point why I like those types of horses. And I evaluate how good they are by how fast they can run early for how long. And that's, to me, that's class, right? If you put American Pharoah in a 6 furlong race, he would win that one too. He'll run fast for longer than other horses that aren't as classy as he is. And I think the best way to identify that and how I identify that classiness is identifying how fast the horses run early. And that tells me how good that horse can be. So that, you know, go out there, go put on your tennis shoes and go outside and run as fast as you can for as far as you can. And then have some top athlete go out or someone who's a little bit classier than you are. And that's kind of where the line is drawn for me when it comes to class.
That's interesting. I never really thought about relating that to class, but that's interesting that that's how – I mean, what it's hard. Those fundamental handicapping factors, and Mike, we'll get you to speak on this part of it. It's interesting how they're all sort of interrelated. The idea of form and class and pace and speed, there's aspects where they're the same and aspects where they're different. Have you ever thought about class in terms of what it means for early speed, the way Jonathan's describing, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of we've heard Randy Moss talk about it on the Moss webinars that we do. One of the big angles he uses is horses that showed some early speed in, say, maiden special weights and then are dropping into maiden claimers. Even if they weren't near the front, they might have been fourth or fifth, two lengths back in a maiden special weight. They drop into a maiden claimer. That's often fast enough to get the lead. So I absolutely, maybe not quite as articulately and as complex as Jonathan described, but I will look at horses that showed speed against much tougher and then get into an easier spot and I will upgrade them, or, you know, and especially if it seems like they're not going to have much early pace pressure, I might put them on the lead and potentially even single them.
For me, I've just always thought about it. I mean, I agree with everything you guys both said on the topic. I've just always thought about it in terms of pace. I feel like that maiden special weight was actually – but I guess you're right, because like if you look at the pars of a maiden special weight to a maiden claimer, the pars for the cheaper horses are actually going to be faster. The way that maiden claimers are run is typically just fast early, and then it's just attrition. And then the big old slowdown happens. So I've always thought, until this moment in my handicapping life, I've thought about it in terms of, oh, well, maybe the maiden special weight won't have to run as fast early. But it's not really that. There is something to this idea of just the classier animal being able to prevail in that spot. So that's good. I just wanted to pick your brain a little bit about that, Jonathan. I think you did a good job there giving folks a little bit of an insight into the handicapping that made you the NHC Tour champ last year. I wanted to talk a little bit about this year's NHC Tour race because Joe Johnson, a 59-year-old gastroenterologist from San Antonio, Texas, won on NHC Qualify last weekend, putting him back in first place and in a really good position from here, I think, to improve his score. And what's really crazy is he's barely played in live events this year because he's been dealing with cancer treatment, which is going really well. He just had he won the contest Saturday and had his last chemo on Sunday. But because he has only the one live score, which he has room to improve in an event like the BCBC, where he's got two entries coming up, he's also still got a fifth online score that could potentially improve. So, Jonathan, I'll ask you, is anybody going to beat this guy? And is the NHC Tour, if it doesn't continue to reside in your house, is it at least going to stay in Texas?
Well, I can tell you what. The Texas Longhorns are back. With a victory over Notre Dame last week, and I'm feeling my Texas pride coming back on. I will be rooting for Joe Johnson. If I see him at an event, I'll be sure to let him know who I like in case he can make any money off of it. I try not to look at the leaderboard too much because it makes me sad. I've just been so busy with a lot of other aspects of my life at the moment. I haven't been able to chase it like I want to, and every time I look at it, I want to go try to win the tour again. So. This is going to help me with that because now I have someone to root for, and having that advantage of being able to improve your scores and being in position late is the best, because a lot of guys, they get high and they can't really improve their score. Like, I got to a point last year where there's nothing I could really do to improve my score. In fact, when I won Gulfstream in September, it literally did nothing for me.
Is that
right?
I was
already kind of maxed out. I got like 200 points and so extra. So I'll be definitely, hopefully can stay in the state of Texas.
The guy who reports on the tournaments probably should have pointed that out in his recap article. But, you know, that guy, he's clued out half the time, so we're not going
to be fair, that guy got a phone call at like 4 in the morning from another guy who happened to be celebrating a little bit too much, laying down in the hallway of my hotel room, not wanting to wake up my friend Nick Tamaro. To your defense, I probably didn't help you much.
Oh, I think that sounds about right. It was 9 in the morning where I was. Actually, it's kind of funny. I'm a little bit sad. The end of Saratoga is always so depressing. And then you get back to real life, and I hate leaving, but once I'm home, I kind of just get into it and get into the new September rhythm. Probably doesn't hurt to have this super fun trip to Toronto coming up this weekend. But then I think about that story you just told, Jonathan, and just generally where I was last year for my departure date would have been the equivalent of this weekend, and having had that great experience spending time over there, it makes me a little sad to not get 9 a.m. phone calls from you when it's 4 a.m. in Florida. But hopefully we'll get a trip back on the calendar to the UK soon, or at least going to be catching up with a lot of UK friends to hopefully give us some good advice and a good steer, and talk a lot about all these Euros who are going to be hopefully coming over for the Breeders' Cup. Couple other things I want to get to from last weekend besides the NHC Tour. You can't stop rock and roll, and you can't stop the DRF Players podcast. Props to Mike Hogan for, not in order, but still, a trifecta is a trifecta. And unless I'm mistaken, Mike, according to my notes, you hit that try in the one dreamer at Kentucky Downs last weekend. I hope you cut a swath out of that race.
Oh, Pete. Yeah.
Didn't work out? Don't tell me you screwed it up.
Well, I did say I'd be boxing them in the Exacta and the Tri.
Yeah.
And then I've got a little bit of a story. It kind of leads into the other story I wanted to tell. And then I went to dinner and totally forgot about the race. So
that sounds like a Jonathan Kinchin move to me.
No, Jonathan doesn't usually leave money on the table like that. But I hope somebody out there followed my advice and did better than I did with it.
I saw some chatter on Twitter. I do believe you helped out some of the listeners. Just more evidence why you have to listen to the show. I mean, I love our Tuesday shows, but these Friday shows, these guys have been on an incredible run. I mean, Jonathan gave out multiple horses this summer that paid over $100. Mike's given out trifectas. You know, there's a lot of good stuff happening. If you're for obviously, I'm preaching to the converted here with everybody listening to the show. But you know what? Tell your friends. Let's make our community bigger. And feel free to leave some reviews on iTunes as well. I feel like we're, given what our numbers are for the show, I feel like we're a little underrepresented. I guess it's because a lot of people access the show not just from iTunes and from other places. But when you leave a review on iTunes and give us a halfway decent rating on there, it does help other people to find the show and just makes the party more fun. So we always appreciate it when listeners do that. Elliot, actually, who has left a review in the past, may now be deleting it or amending it to say, don't listen to the show. Jonathan Kitch keeps saying mean things about my grade one winning horse.
I think Elliot's probably fine with the experience. And, you know, I think he doesn't mind too much. And hey, look, the grade one winning horse is back on the work tab and now in the barn of Todd Pletcher. So who knows? Maybe he might get the last laugh.
Well, I'll be
and I can promise you that I know I said earlier that I don't remember my bad beats. When you're alive to one of the greatest horses of your lifetime for a five-digit score, I think those sometimes can sting. So I'm just being bitter, Elliot. I'm sorry.
Very, very nice. But speaking of the racing from last weekend, was just curious if you guys had any thoughts, any performances to highlight. I'll be honest, I was just kind of half watching. You know, I was paying attention for purposes of hosting the show, but with my focus turning to Breeders' Cup, I didn't have too much to say about racing from last weekend, to be honest. I was in the sort of calm before the storm mode, but I wanted to give you guys a chance to comment on any of the specifics of the races before, Mike, we get a chance for you to talk about the little wagering hiccups that you experienced last week. Anything
you mean? Before I get on my soapbox?
Exactly. You start polishing the soapbox, and Jonathan, I'll ask you, did you see anything on the racetrack last weekend that you wanted to talk about here?
You know, I better go quick because I'll be honest with you. Saturday afternoon, we got a text in our group text from Mike, and it might be the first time I've ever seen him write out a bad word. So I'm assuming this is gonna take the remainder of the show. So I'll say the big hoss was really impressive, and
Claim since Lava Man. That's absolutely best claim since Lava Man.
And I think it was just a listed stakes for sprinters, but I remember last summer them talking about how much they liked Conquest Enforcer, and I heard Patrick Husband say he might be the best horse he's ever sat on, and he's a pretty good horse. He's fun to watch. That was one of the races I tuned in for Sunday in the middle of traveling to make sure that I watched run, and he ran well.
What's next for Conquest Enforcer, do we think?
I have no idea. Aren't they selling all the Conquest horses, or is that?
Yep.
Aren't they dispersing him? So I don't know. Maybe the ring is next for him. Who knows?
Gotcha. Mike, any racing notes before you get up on that, you climb up on that soapbox? Don't hurt yourself. You know.
Well, there were some good races over the weekend. I mean, we saw, we talked about Dale Romans. The name is slipping my mind, but there was a really impressive two-year-old filly he had at Kentucky Downs. I think it was on Saturday. We could see that one showing up in the Breeders' Cup. You know, just some really good races, especially at Kentucky Downs. You know, four stakes races on Saturday. They had their biggest day from a handle standpoint. And you know, we talked about it a little bit. This is like my Christmas. This is people look forward to Saratoga. People look forward to Del Mar. I look forward to the 5 days I get to bet turf racing at Kentucky Downs.
You know, somebody was telling me last night the Meadowlands fall meet is doing something interesting. All turf, or at least they're doing a few cards that are all turf, and only five races. Did you guys hear about this?
I didn't.
We'll do some research. It sounds really interesting to me. I'm always a less is more guy in terms of I love the idea of being able to really handicap every race in a day. And at Saratoga, I tried and I kept up for about 3 weeks, but then it was like getting caught under a steamroller in a fish called Wanda. It was a losing proposition. But the idea of maybe trying to like really pay attention to a little thing like that. My problem with Kentucky Downs is the burnout at the time of year that it happens, and they just look to me like cards that if I was going to handicap properly would take 6 hours. How do you deal with that aspect of it, Mike?
Well, it's a good point. You know, I mean, a lot of times I look at you get a lot of class angles and you get a lot of surface angles. You get a lot of horses coming from Ellis Park in Indiana Grand, and you get many of them who've never tried turf before, or haven't tried turf in a long time, or have had no success on turf. And some of these horses will get well bet because they're in good form. And seemingly from a speed figure standpoint, if they take to the surface, could run well. But a lot of times that's not how it works out. And they're usually in the race just because the purses are so huge. And the trainers figure they might as well give it a shot, because even if they hit the board in $140,000 maiden special weight, you know, that's more than winning at some of the lesser circuits. So I look at the horses coming in with good form, good class. You get such big fields that even with favorites, you know, there were a couple, it was a 4-5 shot that won like a good thing. But this is where I often will use what Jonathan was talking about, which is a horse that just lays over the field. And you're getting a better price than you would elsewhere. You know, maybe 4-5 is not a good example, but you might be getting 2-1 because it's a 12-horse field. I'll happily single those and pick fours and hit it 3 or 4 times. I actually tweeted out some of my selections on Saturday and Sunday for Belmont and Kentucky Downs. And in the early pick four at Kentucky Downs, my $6 all-A ticket hit for 147. So in cases like that, I'll want to have it 3, 4, 5 times, as well as, you know, maybe some larger tickets that might hit too, in case I'm not right with my all A's.
The filly you were referring to, I believe, was Sweeping Patty, Mike. Does that sound right?
That does, yeah.
Big
buyer figure too, right?
She got a 77 going a mile. That's not too bad for a 2-year-old filly, that's for sure. Won by 12.5. By Patio Prado out of the Unbridled Song Dam, C.S. Royce. So one
a full. So that makes her a full sister to Cherry Wine.
Okay, there you go. Well, one to keep an eye on for the Breeders' Cup Turf Juvenile Fillies for sure. While we were handing out kudos, I did forget to pat Jonathan on the back for giving out short price single Wellabled, or as the rest of the world calls him, Wellabled.
I said Wellabled.
Wellabled.
Yeah, I thought it was a LASIK thing.
Oh man. Well, I also want to mention that we've been doing these, helping shepherd these DRF tournaments videos. We got some great submissions from listeners, some of whom will be appearing doing the DRF tournaments plays of the day this week. I say we continue the call another week. Any racing day, if you email us at podcast@drf.com, send us in a nice cogent analysis of a race that's in the DRF tournament sequence, and we will pick a couple of winners to help out and appear on at DRF tournaments, giving out plays of the day. We had a winner also of the shorter variety on Saturday at Kentucky Downs from Kevin Cox, who's doing the analysis down there. What horse was that? Watch Your Own Bobber he gave out. But, you know, hey, a winner is a winner, and we've had a couple of them in there. Is anybody, and I say this knowing that I should be the one doing it, but I'm not, anybody been paying attention? Anybody been tracking what the results are of those DRF tournaments plays of the day, Jonathan?
No, I know my horse is still running. I think Nick Tamaros ran third. I don't really know. Someone had a winner. Didn't
we had a winner early on, and then we had, and then Kevin had the winner. So I think we've had
Blake.
We've
had two, Blake had a winner.
Yeah, Blake had a nice
price
winner.
Yeah.
So we've had. That's not great though. That's we've been doing it about 10 days, and we have two winners. We gotta up the pace, guys. We'll see. Maybe I'll jump in the lineup this weekend when I'm up in Canada, see if I can help the cause instead of just criticizing here from the sidelines. We'll see what we can do. All right, enough of that. We gotta get Mike time to talk about this issue, and we'll talk it through with him. I understand you're going to be writing about it too, which should be interesting. So let's just Mike Hogan, you have the floor.
Yeah, well, and before I start, Jonathan, I'll say maybe it's not on our group text that I've used some salty words, but I do know on another group text that I'm on, my buddy Joe Rizzo often will be driving with his kids in the car and uses the car, you know, modern technology to read the texts that come across. And some of the texts that I sent to that group text after that Reina de Batteria loss, let's just say I'm now infamous in their families. but anyway, on Saturday, I did a little pick five at Belmont Park. And in the first race, I used two horses as A's, including a horse who, Jonathan, like you mentioned, seemingly from a speed figure and pace figure standpoint, seemed like a potential single. But it was a low-level claimer, and so I wasn't going to just single this horse. There was another one that I liked coming off a claim that I thought was interesting. So I used those two as A's, one single backup as a B, and then went out from there. Not a huge ticket, but there was a horse later in the sequence that I liked that I singled. Basically wanted to try and go through that horse. So I'm watching the race, and just prior to the start of the race, when they're loading in the gate, the other horse that I used as an A, the 7, is a gate scratch. And I'm like, oh, geez, I've done it through Ticketmaker, so I've got like 8 or 10 or 12 tickets, and I've got maybe a minute and a half to cancel my tickets and rebet them all if I want to do so. Or I know in New York I'm going to get the favorite at post time on a pick five, because they don't refund, even though the race hasn't started, they don't refund the race or the bets for the pick five on a scratched horse. You get the post time favorite, which is ultimately what my soapbox is all about. It's the only bet. Pick fours, pick fives, pick sixes. If I bet the horse in the pick three, I get a refund. If I bet the horse in the double, I get a refund. Can you imagine putting a win bet on a horse? The horse scratches, and you don't even know which horse you're getting because you're going to get the post-time favorite, and you got to wait until the race runs to figure out which horse you bet on? It happens in the pick five. So anyway, I leave the money on the table. I say, fine, I'll just take double on this favorite now, who still seemingly has a pace advantage. And I sit back and I start, go to watch the race. And what happens? The favorite breaks through the gate. And I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before. My number one bet cancel is a horse that breaks through the gate. I think I've, maybe in the history of my handicapping and betting, I can't remember a time I've ever bet on a horse, had them break through the gate, and then won. I'm sure it's happened.
I've seen
it,
but only like once in a blue moon. It's usually a good cancel.
Yes. So I go in and I'm like, okay, I have one of my A's is a scratch. The other A is a break through the gate. I just want to completely get out of this bet right now. So I go in and I frantically try and cancel my bets, and it's too late because they immediately reload this horse. They don't even check him. They reload this horse. Race has already started, and I'm fully invested, basically now all on this one horse who has broken through the gate. And what happens? He breaks well, sets his pace because he's got that pace advantage, and he tires and gets caught late by a horse that I didn't cover at all. So anyway, fast forward to Kentucky Downs later. Mentioned earlier in the show that I went out to dinner with some friends. Before I did so, I put in a pick five play. It was the pick five at Kentucky Downs is the last five races. The last four races were all stakes. The race before was an allowance race, I believe. Really, really good field, full field. again, there were two horses I used as an A, two or three I used as Bs, and went from there. I put the play in, you know, again, 12 tickets maybe. Oh, probably 20 minutes before post. It was after the race before it, but it was well before they were loading in the gate, and I'm, you know, heading off to dinner with my friends. So I put my play in. It's all submitted and everything. I don't even pay attention. Well, one of my horses that I had used, I guess, and I think the story was, I got to even research it. I think the story was the trainer was too late in getting him to the paddock, so they scratched him in the paddock. So I didn't even realize it, and it was a pretty contested race from a betting standpoint. There were three horses that were vying for favoritism. Turned out I got one of these other horses. I didn't even know who I got. There was a 2.90 compared to 3.20, you know, so very close. And I ended up getting with this horse the same deal. Doubled up on a horse that I was using really just defensively that I didn't really like that much. And I didn't even realize it happened until after the bet had happened. So it's just silly to me, and it seems I can't think of any real good reason why, from a horse player standpoint, you would ever want to just take who the public is going to choose as the favorite. I get it when it's the second or third or fourth leg of a multi-race sequence because
it's a lesser of
not
evils.
Really,
yeah, it's a lesser exactly. of evils. And I agree with you, by the way. I mean, I think it's kind of nuts that they don't refund. And if I were you writing this piece, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, this is horse racing. And there are sometimes weird reasons things happen beyond meets the eye. We saw this with tournaments in New York with the rules, the way a statute is written, you have to bet at least half of your races in New York. So some people, well-meaning, not trying to get any advantage at the Belmont contest several months ago, weren't able to do that correctly, had to get DQ'd, even though it was no advantage to them. It's just like sometimes there's weird things that rules are rules. I'm not saying that's what this is. It could be a case of, I'll just say it. The worst case scenario, it's a greed thing. You know, the racetrack gets the handle if that bet goes to the post time favorite. They don't get handle on a refund. I'm not saying that's what it is, but that's certainly the optics of it. Certainly make it look that way. It's also possible with the Byzantine tote system that there's some sort of technology reason why this is happening. I think it's absolutely worth writing about, Mike, and I think you should go to the source and talk to somebody either on the wagering board or maybe somebody at NYRA to get the specifics of why this is happening. And maybe you can – it could well be something out of NYRA's hands that has to do with the state that maybe an op-ed could be a nice little cudgel they could use to try to get a statute changed. Because I agree with you. I mean, you're the one on the soapbox, but I'll hand you some soap or whatever the correct metaphor is. It's just rotten for horse players, and it really shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, because here's the thing. Let's say you loved that short price favorite, or even the Kentucky Downs, it was the almost 3-1 favorite. Let's say you loved that horse.
They get skunked too.
Yeah, because now you're taking on all of this extra money from a scratched horse, and you end up with an underlay. You know, it doesn't help the person betting on the horse that they want. And what about the horse player who I've heard some people say, oh, well, you got to be paying attention, and they give you time. But, look, how does it benefit anybody to be betting on a horse and then end up with a horse that they weren't betting on? When there's an opportunity to refund the money, it makes no sense. It wouldn't happen in the pick three, never happens in the pick three, wouldn't happen in the double, wouldn't happen in an exacta or a win place or show bet, a superfecta. In no other bet does it work this way. So it just seems like, look, we want to try and encourage new fans to become horse players. This is the sort of thing that makes people go, why the hell would I want to do that? Why would I want to bet on a horse that I might not even get?
Yeah, the optics are bad. And beyond the optics are bad, it's bad for the pocketbook of horse players. You're absolutely right. I just think I would encourage you just do a little bit more digging on the specifics and write a great op-ed, and maybe you can help get this changed. And by the way, Mike, speaking of you and soapboxes, the more I think about the conversation we had in our post-Travers show about the point you made about the rabbit needing to be an entry for the protection of horse players. In other words, so they're not able – so the casual player – at the time, I was kind of like, eh, the casual player who accidentally bets the rabbit, I'm not too worried about him, you know, pick up a racing form. But the more I think about your point, the more I think you've changed my way of thinking on this, that – it's just not fair, and the casual player coming there shouldn't be expected to have to read the article. You, if a horse is offered as a betting interest, that horse's role in the race should be to win, and anything else is deleterious to the game. And so you've turned me around on that. Maybe you can help get the ball rolling to get this, what I agree with you is an unfair situation, changed. So kudos to you for your for your having the backs of horse players. I think you're on to something.
Thanks. One point that I wanted to make is well, two things. One, I have no idea what deleterious means, so I'm going to Google that in a second. The second thing that I was going to say is that, I mean, I ordered groceries yesterday, for crying out loud, through my phone. We've got Uber. You can, you know, check into a flight with your screen of your phone. Like, I cannot believe that there's not some technology in the world that I can't select an alternate selection for a leg of a race of a horse that I actually want to spend my money on. It blows my mind that that's not an option.
You're right. I mean, I could explain why, and it's technical and too boring to bother with. It has to do with the age of the technology and the tote system, and the industry has chosen not to make what would be an incredibly large reinvestment to make things like that happen. And it's something that is worthy of discussion at another time. I did want to get to one question from a listener, Dylan Donnelly, very talented young contest player, was very interested, Jonathan, in what you had to say about how you prepared for the NHC last year, watching as many replays as possible, creating track profiles, learning about the riders at the circuits, et cetera, et cetera. He has won entry into an important online contest that is going to be a 25-race sequence. He wanted me to ask you about some advice for how to prepare for a big-money 25-race contest online.
Yeah, so the NHC was a little bit trickier. What I did then was I tried to watch every race from the 6 weeks leading up to the NHC from every track that was going to be involved. I did okay enough at doing that. I kind of got a little bit late towards the end. And I tried it, you know, obviously it didn't do too much help, but you know, I think doing as much of the preparation you can ahead of time is part of it. I would imagine this tournament he's talking about is going to be on a Saturday. I would get up early on Wednesday and get all of my other life work done. And as soon as entries come out on Wednesday, I would start fully handicapping at whatever pace it is that you handicap. And I would just start knocking out those 25 races. And here's the thing, is there's probably not going to announce the 25 races until later in the week, but you know they're going to be from Belmont. You know they're going to be from you know, Gulfstream or LoSalle or something like that. So I'd find those races that typically show up in those events, you know, Belmont 7th and 8th. They're like usually always in an event because it's in the middle of the day and it's a full field. And I would just try to start handicapping those races ahead of time. If you handicap a race that's not in the sequence, oh, no big deal, but I would try to get as much work done as possible so that you're not you can kind of have a little bit of a plan.
That sounds like a really good idea. I think you knocked that one out. And that's a good idea. I would take a look, pick a time window, take a look at races that are going to be in that time window. You can see from articles you'll read in the racing form, depending on what specific day it is. Is it going to be the big day at Parks? Are those big races going to be in it? You could probably come up with a pretty good guesstimation of a lot of the races and get you know, getting ahead of the game. There's just no, as far as I'm concerned, there is absolutely no substitution for preparation in that situation. So I think you gave some good tools to get there. Final thoughts, gentlemen. Final thoughts on this Tuesday edition of the podcast before we let folks get on with their lives. Mike Hogan, we'll start with you.
Well, Pete, it's International Week here at Daily Racing Form, and you and I are going to be doing some handicapping sessions, live handicapping sessions. We don't call them webinars anymore. We call them live handicapping sessions later this week. I'm excited about both of these. On Thursday, we're going to have Pat Cummings on. We had him on the podcast. We're going to have him do a handicapping session with us, looking at playing the Hong Kong races.
Going is he going to give us a 15-1 shot again? Is he going to give us a 15-1
winner? Let's hope. Let's hope he gives us two. So that will be very cool. That is on Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern time. He's graciously staying up late his time to join us for that. And then on Friday, you're going to be – are you going to be at Woodbine for this? Or you?
Yeah, I'm going to be at Woodbine. I'm going to be sitting in somebody's office. I'm going to go over. We're going to – I'm going to be on with Steve Bick in the morning. We're obviously going to do a podcast that morning. So
right.
I'm going to be a bit of a puddle, I think, in my third hour of broadcasting. But, hey, Bick does it every day. I can do it once in a while.
That's right. Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. on the West Coast, for those of you listening out there, you get a little bit more of a break. As usually we do these at 8 o'clock your time. We're going to be doing the Woodbine Mile Day and have Steve Davidowitz on, looking at, of course, how to win big on racing's biggest days. The Woodbine Mile certainly being one of the racing's biggest days. That should be a fun one. Bring your questions to both. And, of course, as always, if you can't make it in person, they will be archived and posted to drf.com/YouTube.
Jonathan, final thoughts.
Follow the DRF breeding feed. I don't know what it is. Mike will probably know it. But as a newer horse player, it's fun for me now because I'm starting to see babies of horses that I used to bet on. And it's pretty cool. It's just kind of an interesting thing to see. And so – the Keeneland September sale is going on right now, and it's a lot of fun just to kind of see some of those horses, those babies come running around. I think there's like a Hob de Grace baby, a horse, Sweet Lulu, who won at Saratoga. So just some pretty cool stuff. So check that out.
Sounds good. For me, my final thought is just to say I had the pleasure last night of attending Stephen Criss' retirement party. It was great getting a chance to see him, hear all the funny and moving tributes from people throughout the industry who've been influenced by his work over the years. And just wanted to say, again, you know, it was great to have him on the show and just acknowledge once again all the great contributions he's made in both handicapping, literature, and horse player advocacy. Steve, hopefully we'll have a chance to twist his arm and get him on here at some point for a catch-up. But he seemed great. Didn't make it to Saratoga in the end, but was playing Saturdays religiously from home, and it sounded like he had a good meet and is going to keep at least a toe involved recreationally with that new Saturday way of going, which I thought sounded like a good way to really enjoy the best of what racing has to offer and also have a life. Never a bad thing. So that's it for today's show. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin and Mike Hogan. And of course, most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening, especially Dylan Donnelly for submitting that great question. And keep the questions coming. Keep the analysis coming if you want to win an entry into one of our feeder tournaments and appear in the @DRF Tournaments Twitter feed. We'd love to hear from you. We will be back on Friday. If you're playing this week, may you win all your photos.